these guys, they really understand their main mission in life is to make you, CIO, CEO, well, you, the company, successful at doing this. And while for us, it may be mundane, it may be slow, it may be not, if only that CIO or customer experience officer underwrote that risk and said, let me go and do it. Maybe they look like a hero quickly. Maybe we're a growth stock and those guys are the S&P 500.
Hello and welcome to Deep Learning with Poly AI. I'm Michelle and I'm joined here by our CEO and co-founder, Nicola. And today we're talking about managing disruptive change. So this is something that we've seen a lot of in our years of deploying and selling AI to large businesses. But it's also something we've been hearing a lot more from the market, just people telling us, how do I think about everything that comes after buying your technology? How do I think about circulating this and helping the other people, the other stakeholders in my business understand the value that this is driving and the change that's likely to stream down from this choice? And so it's something that I think is worth talking about today. So welcome, Nicola. Excited to get into this with you.
Absolutely. Change management. What a wonderful world. Like I think when we started, I was like, what does it mean? And think of the context of space, you immediately think of change and like how people work and stuff. But I've come to understand that it's really also people buying this kind of software and launching it in companies that are that large. They're really thinking they're playing chess with components that are really like, hey, if I put this system in, what's support going to look like? What it is? How long is it going to take? How much institutional resistance is there going to be? It's not an easy job. I used to think of it as just like big companies don't want to do things, but hey, it's far from the truth. I think doing this well and pitching it well and de-risking it for the rest of your org, and ideally, hopefully, you've picked out something that would be possible. Like it's what a good CIO needs to do, right?
Yeah. I think the key word here is definitely disruptive change, because obviously we know big companies have more mass, they move slower, it's harder to make certain types of decisions. But especially when you have something disruptive and you have like a large, you have a large footprint, like you have a large amount of teams and people and processes that are going to be impacted by disruptive change, there's a lot more, you have to have a much bigger focus on managing that change. And part of it, just to get to the kind of heart of it, is political, right? Like you don't want, as an individual, to bring in a decision that was sold to you that is going to have an impact on your personal career. And AI is one of those areas that I think is particularly disruptive and particularly risky for the individual that brings it in.
You think? Why?
Well, because things can go wrong. I think we've seen it happen a lot recently. Of course, the names aren't associated with these. Like all the brands that have had very public sort of generative AI failures in the last month, nobody's saying the CIO is directly responsible for this or the person who's accepted the project or signed
off. Someone inside those doors is saying that for sure.
but it's definitely happening internally and everybody's looking at it. So when you think about the political capital you need to spend in order to drive disruptive change, it's no small fee.
Absolutely. You're putting a lot on the line. There's a lot to gain as well, right? Like the AI champions of today are the CIOs for everything of tomorrow, right? But yeah, I think it's really hard to convince an org to do anything, right? And like these days, it's probably, in our experience, it's hard to convince an org to do something that's not the good old buying IBM, except these days it might be Google or something else, right? I think you again, like in our favorite notation, have to split the world into those with like weak IT, where they're not going to build it all themselves, and those that are mounting offensives that will be remembered mostly for the wasted resources. But hey, like someone advised it. And I saw an interesting data point, and it's basically that Accenture is at this point the largest generative AI company by revenue, that their reported Gen AI revenue, and what this means, I am no earnings expert. I think we'll decipher what I think it was a $1.1 billion quarterly result of Gen AI revenue. What is implementation? What is recurring? How it works? I have no clue, right? But it's interesting because it tells you that they're flocking to, if we're going to be cynics, and we love doing this podcast, your outsourcing responsibility to a trusted partner, right? Yep. And that trusted partner is like, I'm going to spend your money and hopefully provide something that makes your career, but it won't break it because it's on them, right?
Yeah.
no one ever got fired for trusting Accenture with an AI project, right?
Yeah.
So that's the same idea, right?
But it is interesting, like this idea that you can export risk onto kind of like a, you know, a kind
mm-hmm. yep. of yep.
a third party or something. But we talk a lot about the CIO and like the IT yep. department, like you mentioned, they are the ones that are designing their orgs for the future and bringing yep. AI in. But it's not just the CIO. And it's not just the IT person. Like the C-suite needs to be bought in. I think like when you look at the companies where successful disruptive transformations have taken place, it's because from the very top down, there's been a willingness to take on that risk and a willingness to say like, yeah, we brought on Accenture.
Yeah, ride the risk. The reason why an Accenture will be successful and companies like Accenture, hugely valuable for the tech ecosystem, right? And it's like you and I spend a lot of time, we just did, like thinking about what are we pitching to whom? What's the story? What do they care about? And maybe we're the smartest people in the universe, but I can only cover so much ground. Whereas someone like Accenture knows and has people, we work, some of our advisors are former Accenture people and they're brilliant, right? And yeah. they know exactly the way that a CIO of a certain kind of a public company thinks. And they know how the CIO thinks. They know where they've been burned before. They know what kinds of mistakes those companies tend to make in terms of planning rollout times, planning budgets, planning mundane things that we don't even think about. Because we as a startup, what is a startup? It's a flicker in time, right? And some of them make it and become a Google, but the rest are just like absorbed by others, right? And they become part of some other narrative. And these guys, they really understand their main mission in life is to make you, CIO, CEO, well, you, the company, successful at doing this, right? And while for us, it may be mundane, it may be slow, it may be not, if only that CIO or customer experience officer underwrote that risk and said, what Michelle and Nicole are saying makes sense, let me go and do it. Maybe they look like a hero quickly. Maybe we're a growth stock and those guys are the S&P 500. And really, it's their job to be the S&P 500. If they're not, then someone else will be the new Accenture. So I think like the whole piece there, actually, when you boil it down to its pragmatic factors, becomes, well, hey, maybe the safest thing they could be doing is going with the flow. The only danger there is, do they really think that those guys can give them what they need fast enough? And are they comfortable with the business model? Because the business model is $1.1 billion of, at the end of the day, mostly professional services. So you're paying for a lot of salaries. And do you really believe that they've ramped people in a field that's completely and utterly new? They have now ramped those thousands needed to charge you and everyone else that kind of money to do it. Well, sure, your job will be safe, but it's probably not going to be the best move for your career.
Yeah, but what makes sense and what I'm hearing here is like startups, we tend to be very focused on our own story and how our own story impacts sort of the champion that we're speaking to, but not necessarily everything that comes after that and everything that the champion is going to have to face. Whereas Accenture is literally staffed up to think about every phase of that deployment, like every bit of that change. Accenture, in essence, is set up to do change management from the top down. So their staffing is like future-proofing the decision that a company makes to use generative AI in some spots. So it makes sense that you'd want to partner with them.
They're selling you insurance, right? We've seen this a gazillion times when similar companies are involved. You dial into a call as a startup that has a hard-won opportunity to do something amazing, right? You put a killer team on it, and Poly AI team of four people is ready. They know all there is to know. They're ready to start going. Partner dials in with 10, 20, 30, 40 people, right? And I'm like, what are you all doing?
Yeah.
Like, they're doing change management, right? Well, yeah. I mean, they're billing hours. They're like lawyers, right? But more importantly, like, they're also there to reassure those guys that, like, they have a team. And is that really, you know, kind of, is that really the kind of like change is they need? Is it going to move fast enough? Is it just reassurance? I don't know. But it's
also, they've got such a wide set of people that are on that call listening from perspectives that they know that the business should have. So somebody's there, like we have prospect calls all the time with very, very wide teams. And these are early phase calls where you'll see 10 people show up, all from different angles in the business that are going to care about the technology, that are going to care about the change that we're bringing, that this product is bringing. And they're all there to represent their perspective. And that is the earliest stage of change management, which is like understanding the impact from their own perspective and then being able to blend it and then being able to figure out how we then go forward from here. So yeah, and maybe a good question to start with is just like, what are the signs of an organization that's ready to absorb this kind of transformational change? Like, what have you seen of clients that we've sold to and have been successful in deploying a very large scale AI project within their business? Like,
they're ready to learn. Ready to learn, right? There is a champion who's eager to scale a new kind of org structure. Like, they have a few competent lieutenants who are really setting about, they're motivated to wrestle the whole organization, not into shape. That's a disrespectful way to put it. They are there to be your interlocutors with a world that you don't understand. Because all of our clients are very different. They talk about customer experience metrics in different ways. They talk about abundance and satisfaction and CSATs and NPS scores in different ways. They talk about them in ways that really pertain to their metrics, right? Like what an abandon is to a hospitality group is different to what it is for a bank. For a bank, it's a churned, potentially churned customer, right? Because at the end of the day, it's a zero-sum game. You have to have a bank account. I have to have a bank account. And we might flock to a different bank if we get pissed off by our existing one. Whereas to a hospitality group, like it's much more immediate. If you as a casino are not picking up, maybe I am. And I think what you're looking for when you do change management and something that will make a big difference to the company, you're really looking for someone to be your interlocutor, right? Like you have gone into a foreign land, you do not speak the language, and you've got that one translator who's there to not just translate, but really like when someone's translating and you see that they're actually like decorating, changing what you're saying, really making sure that you've said what you should have said rather than what you might have said. Maybe you were disrespectful. Maybe you didn't prioritize the right thing. Maybe you were dismissive of something that seems like an easy problem to you, but you don't appreciate the legacy, like Hydra, that they are like wrestling with to get your little system implemented and get you that API. Maybe there's a team of 20 InfoSec engineers who'd really just rather not do this, right? And maybe the support, it's politics, as you said. Maybe your support vis-a-vis InfoSec is not strong enough, but they really need to find a way for you not to antagonize them or seem to like too much of a risk. You probably aren't. One wrong word, one sentence that reminds them of a different mishap that happened 5 years ago could be the end of you. And they're there to give you the momentum as well internally to constantly wrestle with the different departments and highlight your successes. Like when you're a small AI company doing something with a large enterprise, you're constantly selling and you can't really sell it all that effectively because you've sold it to your champions and they're the ones that are affecting the change. Mm-hmm. They need to sell it to everyone else.
That's really interesting that you say that. I remember part of what it sounds like this interlocutor's like giving the transformation is context, the historical context, the understanding of like where the landmines are to avoid, how to speak, how to think about certain things. But just thinking about context in a bigger way, just in terms of whether or not an organization is ready for a major transformation is just like the context that COVID gave us. If you wanted to know if an organization's ready for a big change, one of the things would be to look back at what happened in 2020 and how quickly the organization was able to adapt to a big transformational change that was outside of their control. And now here, yes, you get the chance to say yes or no to generative AI. You get the chance to say, yeah, I want to hire Accenture or not. But really, I think our thesis is that this is inevitable. It's inevitable for every enterprise we talk to. Like at some point, some process is going to be completely transformed by AI. Obviously, we hope it starts with the contact center because that's an area in which you can prove strong ROI. And you can use the same language as the teams that want to see these benefits coming from AI. But yeah, I think that's one bit of historical context. Like, how do you guys handle COVID?
No, absolutely. I think that who handled COVID well, right? I don't know. We worked with a number of banks. One of them moved fast and secured all the kind of bounce back loans, and they've been profitable ever since. Is it attributed to Churchill? Never let a good crisis go to waste. So I think like that allows agents of change and companies to move a lot faster, sometimes with impunity, because they have to move, right? And were they ready? Did they have the right people? Did they have to move? In the end, when you look at COVID, it was such a permanent thing that people, companies were, right? They adapted. They all did, right? Yeah. Some better than others. But I remember I was with Three in the UK at Telco, and they didn't have a contact center for weeks. Others adapted more quickly. I'm no longer a Three customer, right? I'm an EE customer for a different reason, but this definitely didn't help. And does it pertain to Gen AI? Is there a genetic indicator of a large enterprise that tells you whether they're like more likely to reinvent themselves? I don't know. I think it's like different times, different companies, right? Like it's everything from ownership structure to the culture, right? A lot of these companies have existed much longer than we've been alive, right? Yeah. So like they're living entities with habits, with you know, like centers of gravity inside them that matter.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like we see this a little bit. Like maybe COVID's a bad example now that I'm hearing you say that, just because it was forced upon a lot of these companies. But like you think about the cultural aspect of what you were just saying, it's like maybe risk tolerance, like being able to measure whether or not a company is likely to usher in the next wave of digital transformation, which is AI within their organization.
I think the cloud is the best analogy, right? Because I think people, if you look at the Batteries Open Cloud Summit, I remember seeing some projections of like GDP growth there, and what did the cloud do? What will generative AI do? Obviously, we share the sentiment, but it's really much more about who jumped on that, who moved fast. Like they reaped the rewards. At the time, it seemed reckless. You were giving Amazon mostly all your data, right? All your data is now stored with them. It's not safely tucked away in your data center. And sure, maybe they have more resources to keep it safe and defend it against every threat. But you don't know that. You're making a big risk. You probably seemed foolhardy to most. And if you were selling it with just cost implications, it might have been those that had to get that cost implication on their books to stay solvent as a company. It might not be that they were more in it. I don't know. I think it's, at least from our experience, and we've done some pretty massive things with massive companies, it's always the champion, right? The champion is someone who's at the right place at the right time, right? They're like key quarterback that is there to carry through. And I like to think that I like a good hero narrative. And I think it's like that person is there because often it's someone who's been in that company for a while and knows it really well. They're fed up with something.
Yep.
And they love that company. Yep. Right. And it's that love for the company and the knowledge of all of their peers, the belief that they're a good steward of the company,
mm-hmm.
earned them the right to take that risk.
Yeah.
Right. And then they fight for the opportunity to take the risk.
Yep.
And hopefully they make the right call. Right. And we've spoken about our champions and their like promotion paths, and people do it, sure, to get promoted, but that's a cynical view. They do it because they see an opportunity and they are stewards of their companies who care about, I don't know, improving customer experience. CSAT and NPS scores. They want to reduce the abandon rates. And in our case, they've tried everything. They can't find the people to man their contact centers. So they're resorting to AI. And we live in the greatest era that AI has ever had. So I think the interest rates are lower. It's easier to take that risk right now because you have air cover from other executives who've been told that if they don't do this as a company at scale,
exactly,
they won't be a company in 20 years, right?
Exactly. So
there's something in the water, and there's a lot about the show.
Yeah, AI should be seen as less a risk and more an opportunity. And exactly your point, like a person who really loves the company and sees themselves as a steward of its toward its future. Well, like this is much more of an opportunity than something to be risk mitigated, something to be like, I don't know, balanced out politically with something else. Like this is much more about the longevity of the company. And I think that's probably one of the interesting knock-on effects of a really good transformational project is that you get more loyalty from all of the other people in the business who saw it the same way, who saw the transformation, whatever it was. But in this case, we're talking about AI as an opportunity for the company to keep up, to have a competitive advantage, to survive.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that probably is a very, very overlooked part of change management is how can you use this to foster more loyalty with your employee base, not just customer base, not just be a better kind of competitive brand, but like actually use this to build better relationships with your existing employees.
Yeah. I mean, like if you implemented something that might have helped the company's P&L a little, but it's like done damage internally and people are using a system they absolutely hate, you'll probably have employee churn and just like a lack of satisfaction internally that will manifest in other ways. So these companies, they move slowly. Some move slowly and carefully to make the right decisions. Some just move slowly and become obsolete, right? And that's, I think, that's capitalism, right? That's why it's a good thing. As long as the companies are not too big to fail, they'll get disrupted by those that can reinvent themselves a lot faster. With AI, I think, with cloud, we saw a whole generation of challenger banks, others who stopped thinking about branches and started thinking about like better apps where you can do everything a lot more quickly. Yeah, and with AI, we'll see services and products that will mix a formerly good product with an infinite supply of services around it that would have previously been available to, I don't know, top 0.1% of the population with, I don't know, private wealth advisors, right? One of our colleagues today mentioned to me that they read a stat that like more wealth creation has happened for like age 25 to 45 over the past decade than ever. And I found that surprising because it's not necessarily the narrative we always read about when you look at like the impoverishment and the inability of younger people to get access to housing and everything else boomers would have taken for granted. But commoditization of apps like Robinhood, trading 212 and others, buying fractional shares and stuff have just like commoditized the access to these things. And with AI, we'll get like the extension of private wealth advisor might have done for a British aristocrat what AI will do for you and I, right? And then we're leveling the playing field. And God knows, our AI shares data and becomes better than that. One guy in the city who's getting advice from it makes over a pint, right? So companies will either evolve, and the CIOs and other champions that have brought in AI will be lauded as change management leaders because they managed to shift Titanic away from the glacier. Or Titanic will hit the glacier and a bunch of little frigates will sail on the sky, getting crews and growing. I don't know if that's a good analogy.
Different kind of change management in the disaster case. So I think just like maybe to wrap up, to talk about what people can do to be a steward of that kind of change within their business. So one thing I heard from you is like they've got to be looking out for the opportunity and care deeply about it and care deeply about the company. Yep. And it's not just like a power grab. It's not just a looking over your shoulder at what your competitor is doing and trying to just keep pace. It's about choosing to do something, choosing to transform for the right reasons. Yeah. Any other advice or anything that you've seen work with our own customer base?
I think also like start small, right? I think like the real issue, like the antibodies of companies that have been developed to stop weird things getting in and causing wreaking havoc, right? Mean that often there are these like RFPs and torturous things that actually favor the Accentures and others of the world. Not for a bad reason. Those guys know what is likely or not likely to work, but they won't take the risks, right? So I think like as much as I have a problem with our teams like piloting things to death, start small. It doesn't have to mean that you're piloting and implementing something and making a company do 20 backflips to show to you that they're the best, because you probably can't even tell. What you need to see if there's like a company product fit, right? Where like you as a stakeholder in a large company, you need to find a way to test out whether this will make sense in that context. And even you, no matter how tenured you are, you don't really know. So you start with a small dose. You see what happens, right? And there's a bad reaction, you stop. And if it's working well, you up the dose, right?
Yep.
And that's the way to de-risk it. But it's important to start and learn things. And I think that the more of this you do, some of our buyers are mavericks at how they like get good deals out of startups or on how they get startups to bend over backwards and do a lot of work. That's not even like their core product, but like to really push them to figure it out for the company. The more you do it, the better you get, and the more chances you get to do it. So the best people we work with, I sit down with them and I won't name this person. They hear they'll recognize themselves. The first 30 minutes, he told me about everything that he did with other startups and the negotiations. And I have to say, I felt a bit of like trepidation at like, oh my God, like we are going to have fun as this scales up. This won't be easy. But let me tell you, it's been massively successful because while problem solving, the deal got better for us and for them. And we did things that helped our product roadmap. And I think like the more of it you do, the more fun you have, then you get better at it. And before you know it, you're actually just a constantly evolving your company to do it and building it for yourself. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that maverick energy is contagious. It even jumps companies, it sounds like you said, going from
these people yeah. don't stay in the same place for way too long because the skill set is rare because few dare to do it that often. And there's risk to it. So God knows for each one of the person I'm thinking of, there may be a few that got burned. But this is where I think America is a great place. Like, and why, like, we grow a lot faster. We do a lot more work in America than we do in Europe. And I say this as like a self-deprecating European. In America, they ask what you've learned when you failed. In Europe, they just like really think carefully, like measure thrice, cut once. And I think even if you mess up, okay, you're probably the first to have messed up.
So yeah, exactly.
If you're a relatively reasonable person, the next time you do it, you've got a better shot than anyone else.
So true. I really, really love that. I think that's a really nice note to end on. It's just this idea that if you've done the initial parts of change management well, which is, I think there are two different models. One is the maverick model. You believe deeply in this. There's a lot of charisma associated with it. You're doing it for the future of the business and you are just like going. And that energy is just, again, like it's contagious. It's exciting from the top down. And then there's just like the more Accenture kind of tried and true model, which is like, I understand that each individual stakeholder is going to be impacted by this change. And I know how to communicate to them and I know how to soften the blow before it even, of whatever that change is, before it even comes. And both of those have great merit. And even in both of those models, you'll probably see failures. You'll especially given the newness of the stage of AI that we're in now. But it's okay because everybody bought into the idea. Everybody bought into the opportunity. I think the maverick can get away with it a little bit better.
Listen, I think that it's also like in many of these processes, there are the mavericks, there's everyone. And not infrequently, we end up like working hand in hand with the larger size because, you know, we're all rowing in the same direction. And our role is to be a small freight and theirs is to be an aircraft carrier. And they all have a role to play in a modern Navy.
Everyone from the Titanic to there. That's it's a better spot, has a better fate.
Wow.
Awesome. Well, this was a fun conversation. Thanks, Nicola. Until the next one.
Yeah, the next one. Thank you.